From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Pope Francis's visit to Myanmar this week has been marked not by what he said, but by what he didn't say. The outspoken religious leader has condemned Myanmar's brutal pogrom against the Rohingya Muslim minority in the past, saying, quote, they have been suffering, they are being tortured and killed simply because they uphold their Muslim faith. But during his highly anticipated visit to Myanmar, he did not mention the word Rohingya. Leading up to the Pope's visit, the government of Myanmar had been in talks with neighboring Bangladesh, where hundreds of thousands of Rohingya have been fleeing to in order to escape the latest round of systematic violence, rape, and killing by Myanmar's soldiers and others. The talks centered around a repatriation agreement that would allow the voluntary return of about 100,000 Rohingya in exchange for Myanmar's immunity from criminal prosecution. My guest is Edith Mirante. She is the director of Project MAGE, an independent information project on Burma and Myanmar human rights and environmental issues. She's the author of two books on the country, and most recently her most recent book is entitled The Wind in the Bamboo: Journeys in Search of Asia's Negrito Indigenous Peoples. She covered the 1990s Rohingya refugee exodus to Bangladesh. Welcome to the program, Edith.
Thank you, Sonali, and it's good to be on Rising Up, Uprising. I've been covering this issue for a long time, not just the current crisis, but the background on the current crisis. So
yes, and a lot of that is thanks to you, and you're approaching me many years ago, so I really appreciate your work as well on this, Edith. Let's talk about the Pope's visit, because this is a Pope that has not remained silent on other issues. On, you know, he has spoken out against Turkey's role in the Armenian genocide. He's spoken about, he doesn't hold back, let's put it this way, when it comes to issues of human rights violations. And he has spoken out about the Rohingya and what's been done to them in the past. How do you view what many are calling a sort of diplomatic tightrope that he has walked in Myanmar this week?
Well, of course, people do look to Pope Francis for peace and justice messages and action. This is a historic visit, the first visit by a pope to that country. And there were a lot of requests from the Catholic clergy in Burma, in Myanmar, that he be careful about using the very name Rohingya, because that is just a live wire in the country. They were afraid that that would provoke violence, burning of churches, even killings by the Buddhist majority against the small Christian and even smaller within that Catholic minority in the country. Burma, Myanmar has its first cardinal, Cardinal Bo. He's very influential, and him and other bishops apparently lobbied for not using the word Rohingya. So far, Pope Francis has not done so within the country, although he did have meetings with the head of state, Aung San Suu Kyi, and the head of the military, General Min Aung Hlaing. And it's very possible that he used the word to them, and very hopeful that this issue was brought up. In the past, he's spoken of our Rohingya brothers and sisters. What might be more telling is his next stop on the trip, actually, which is Bangladesh. And he does have on his agenda meeting with Rohingya refugees. I don't think it's logistically possible for him to go to the camps in the south of the country, but apparently representatives of the Rohingya refugee community may come to him. So we'll hear much more about that issue in the next couple of days. And it's worth remembering that at this point, there are now more Rohingyas displaced out in the world, especially in Bangladesh, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them, including more recently arrived 600,000. There are more of them there than there are back inside their homeland in Burma, in Myanmar.
Now, so it's possible that the Pope might have mentioned the word Rohingya, even brought up the issue in private. But what would have happened if he had said it out loud? Wouldn't the symbolic gesture have meant a lot to Rohingya, especially in the diaspora, as they're watching him. His visit was something that had been sort of politicized even before it happened, with a lot of people in Myanmar worried that he would bring this issue up, almost ready to do political battle before he stepped on the country's soil. Are you disappointed he didn't take a more forceful position?
I'm seeing more disappointment from international human rights activists and observers than from some of the Rohingya themselves. They've said, we know his heart is with us. We appreciate what he's done and what he's trying to do. But then, yeah, on the other hand, it's like it would be a major statement for him to have simply said their name. And part of genocide is denying people their entire identity, their entire name. And it's very telling that the mere word of these people's name for themselves could potentially provoke violence against a totally other ethnic group, a totally different religion, that is that bad in this country, in Burma, at this point, that just one word has created such a climate of fear for people who aren't even directly involved.
Right, just the term Rohingya is something that the hardline in Myanmar take great issue with, as if they don't want to acknowledge that these are people that exist. But of course, what they want to say is that these are people whose homeland, indigenous homeland, is not Myanmar. The situation is very, very dire. And so dire that even the United States has, under the Trump administration, which has of course been very quick to demonize Muslims, has taken a position on it. I was surprised that earlier this month, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson issued a statement saying that what was happening in Myanmar was a clear case of ethnic cleansing. He used that term, ethnic cleansing. How important is that?
It is important. It is very obvious that there is an attempt to completely drive these people out of their homeland. That's the definition of that. It's also considered a crime against humanity, what's happened to them, and there are legal implications of that in international law. And then there's the question of genocide. Is this not only an attempt to drive them out of the country, but an attempt to basically wipe them out as a people? Even an attempt to do that is considered genocide. And again, that's something that could potentially end up in international criminal courts and so on. So the United States hasn't gone as far as calling it genocide. Another term that's been used is apartheid, and that's dating back quite a few years in Rakhine State. A recent report by Amnesty International has said this is really definitively apartheid, and that the Rohingyas are denied access to normal services like healthcare, education, travel, marriage. So that has also come up recently. Fortify Rights and the Holocaust Museum have joined in a recent report on the crimes against humanity. And then there's another recent report by Human Rights Watch on gender violence, on the use of mass rape against Rohingya women and girls, children really, in the northern part of Rakhine State.
And I do want to get to that issue. Rape as a weapon of war is sadly the all too common tool used by dominating armies. But let's also talk about the other sort of news issue that came right before the Pope's visit, and that was the agreement between Bangladesh and Myanmar on so-called repatriation. Now, Bangladesh has come under fire in the past for not being friendly to Rohingya. However, in this latest pogrom that was conducted over the summer and late summer against the Rohingya, it has received praise for receiving the Rohingya. Now there are an estimated 1 million Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh. What do you make of this repatriation agreement? Something like 100,000 Rohingya will be repatriated into Myanmar as a voluntary act but there's nowhere for them to go. Also, Myanmar, of course, wins, as far as I can tell, complete immunity from the crimes that it has committed. What do you make of this agreement?
Well, it's just a memorandum of understanding between Bangladesh and Myanmar, Burma. It's quite unrealistic at this point. Certainly, no one wants to go back to a place where they are still burning villages and still raping women. And the safer areas consist of walled-off camps for the Rohingyas, in the more southern part of the state or central part of the state. So it's absolutely unrealistic that anyone could go back, could or should go back under these conditions. Also, the Rohingyas themselves are completely left out of this memorandum of understanding. It's between two countries and nothing to do with them or their opinions or their agency in this. The first big exodus of the Rohingyas that I witnessed personally was in 1991. And at that time, there was forced repatriation from Bangladesh. Rohingyas were starved literally in their camps. They were beaten. All kinds of punitive measures were instituted in Bangladesh to make them go back. And there was a small UN High Commissioner for Refugees presence inside their homeland in Rakhine State, but it really couldn't protect them from anything. So there was this kind of revolving door going on at the time where people were fleeing, people were being pushed back. We don't want to see a repeat of that by any means. We also don't want Bangladesh to relocate refugees from where they are now to a flat little island that's flooded most of the year, which is another plan that they've put in place. With that said, there have been definitely missteps by Bangladesh, but all in all, in this current crisis, they've been enormously generous, enormously hospitable. The ordinary people of Bangladesh have risen to the occasion in such an inspiring way and brought supplies before international agencies even were there. Even the villages along the river border have been just amazing at hosting this influx of poor, traumatized people from the neighboring country. And one last problem at the moment is that there are thousands and thousands of people stranded on the other side of that river still. So one thing that really could be done would be rescue boats for them, which is problematic for Bangladesh. Burma might not let them land. But that's the kind of memorandum of understanding that we really need. It's just the ability to simply rescue some people rather
Well,
than.
the leadership in Myanmar and Bangladesh seem to put a lot more stock in the memorandum. They are saying that there will be a speedy, the arrangement will be carried out in a speedy manner. They expect the return of refugees to start within 2 months. Bangladesh's foreign minister has said that this is a primary step, but they will take back the Rohingya, and now we have to start working. That sounds exceedingly optimistic, and also doesn't seem to take into account what the Rohingya themselves want, right? I mean, this whole idea of self-determination is lost in the mix. I mean, they seem to be still treated as a people with no agency.
I think a lot of it's a diplomatic and PR move to get the international community off their backs. As far as Myanmar, they think, we'll just tell them what they want. They want everybody to just go back. But what they would be going back to would be, again, camps. There's definitely a plan in place to turn over the places where the Rohingyas lived to other people. We've seen that in the past also. A lot of people who are not Rohingya being settled in that part of the northern part of the state. And their rice has already been harvested with Kubota machines and taken away. Their cattle have been taken away and sold, and their villages are in ashes. So, what they're being offered is something like the people who are living in miserable conditions down near the main city, Sitwe, are living in, which are camps.
Let's talk about...
You would rather live in a camp in Bangladesh and be safe than live in a camp back there.
Let's talk about what was done particularly to women and girls in this latest round of violence that led to the 600,000 strong exodus. Human Rights Watch put out a report that I mentioned about sexual violence against the Rohingya. And the stories were unbelievable. They basically documented instances where women, and as you said, children, young girls, were gang raped to death. This just is unimaginable. If I just sort of imagine if this had been happening to any other community, that there would be so much outrage the world over. Can you give us a sense of how new this is, or is this sort of part of the standard way in which Myanmar has treated Rohingya through previous exoduses?
Well, not only is it not new, it's standard in ethnic areas throughout Burma and has been for decades. This is how the Burmese military has operated. There was a report many years ago called School for Rape, meaning that the army was literally told and trained to do these things. And that was in the Shan state. It was the Shan Women's Organization who compiled that report. And there's been loads of documentation ever since then about this syndrome, that is a part of military operations when they are in ethnic areas. It's a deliberate attempt to humiliate them, to dominate them, literally. And it's done with enormous cruelty. In the case of the Rohingyas, it's on a massive scale. The army and government officials and their enablers deny it, saying that Rohingya women are too ugly to rape. That's their basic defense.
Wow.
They say, who would touch them? They've said this kind of thing over and over again. And in reality, it happens to children or anyone who's in their line of control. The violence against children has been extreme in the case of the Rohingyas recently. Of all the human rights abuses that are going on, we've seen them all before with the Kachins, with the Karens, with the Shans, but not as much directed against children and even infants as there is currently.
Infants.
That's one thing that's really particularly standing out is the killing of children. And a lot of children have fled. There are thousands of unaccompanied children whose parents have been killed. Most of the refugees in Bangladesh are women and children, which leads us to believe that the men have been massacred. There are some starting to be documentation of some massacres that have gone on, but because there's not outside access or investigation, we don't really know what's happened to the men, including men with cell phones who were documenting what was going on.
Right. There was a report actually by The Guardian suggesting that Myanmar may have killed off the underground Rohingya journalists who've been trying to document what's happening.
Yeah, that's how we really have found out a lot of what happened with the villages burning and the people fleeing. Was just from these cell phone videos, and then they've kind of stopped. And there has been this kind of Khmer Rouge thing of singling out people who had an education, maybe, even though it's hard to get much of an education when you're Rohingya, or you know, people with glasses on, or people with books, or people with a phone. So we've seen people from all walks of life fleeing. It's not just peasant farmer, rice farmers, but it's merchants who had money. It's people who are from the towns as well. This is really an across the board. Anyone of any age can be killed. Anyone of any status can be killed.
One of the things that the Human Rights Watch report also mentioned was that the systematic nature of rape as a tool was apparently intended to create so much trauma among the women and the girls that they would associate their homeland with this trauma and be disinclined to want to return. Have you heard this?
Well, it's successful. Yes, it's a traumatizing, deliberate traumatizing right. an entire right. people. And so then it's not just the women themselves, but their entire families. And this goes back to in the 1990s, the first Rohingya refugees I met, I interviewed a very young teenage girl. And I said, well, why did you come here? Why did you cross the border to Bangladesh? And she said, well, the soldiers wanted to rape me. So this is something that has continuously gone on with this particular military force, which is a very, very large, very well-funded military force.
Let's talk about the role of Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel Peace Prize winning human rights activist from Burma, from Myanmar, who essentially has been the most disappointing figure on this issue of the Rohingya, not just through her silence, but actually through her assertions that this is an internal matter. She expressed publicly anger that the United Nations has passed resolutions on what's happened to the Rohingya, saying that this is a bilateral issue between Myanmar and Bangladesh. And you know, you and I have talked about Aung San Suu Kyi back in the day when she was held under house arrest. What do you make of her, what appears to be an exceedingly hypocritical position at best, but at worst, an active participant in this pogrom against the Rohingya?
Well, her press office has called the accounts of the gender violence, quote, fake rape. They actually used that
wow.
term. This, again, dates back quite a while. She's had many, many more chances than Pope Francis has to use the word Rohingya, and she never does. She is not the power behind this thing. The military is under General Min Aung Hlaing. And between the two of them, they really have marshaled this third force, which is the public support for it, the hatred of the Rohingyas, the use of racial and ethnic and religious slurs against them, the really vicious social media campaigns, which count for a lot in Burma these days, since they're fairly recent adapters of social media and it's very influential and people don't know how to filter through things. So Min Aung Hlaing was involved in very similar campaigns up in, again, the north, up near the China border against the Kokang Chinese people who are resident in Burma and the Shan people. And at that time, he managed to get public opinion against these alien Chinese ethnic people, as they are now against these alien so-called Bengali Rohingyas. So they've really kind of actively marshaled the goodwill people have for her, the love they have for her, and more recently, a new respect for the army as a, you know, national force. For decades and decades, they've been told the army is your mother and your father, the army will save the country, and all that was under a military dictatorship. And a lot of people didn't buy it. And now all of a sudden, there's this quasi-democracy, and people are buying that. They are buying into that the army can do no wrong.
What do you think lies, finally, what do you think lies in the future for the Rohingya, this people that are unwanted by those who rule their homeland? They are not being allowed to have a seat at the table when decisions are being made. And Myanmar is an extremely dangerous place for them to simply exist. Their homes have been completely destroyed for many of them. Is there any sort of bright light for them in Myanmar? I can't imagine a scenario where they could return to Myanmar unless there was some sort of clear international guidance or presence or oversight to ensure their return and their safety?
Yes, it would have to be protection. There was a commission headed by Kofi Annan, the former UN Secretary General, which recommended many things, including citizenship for the Rohingya, which they don't have, which is one of the root causes of all of this. And it's pretty good. You know, that could be followed. The government had said they were going to go along with it, and then violence broke out. The crisis broke out. The violence was building up before the Kofi Annan Commission was announced, before the Muslim insurgent group attacked police posts. There were already Burmese government military forces being stationed en masse in that area. But anyway, because of this violent crisis, that commission's recommendations have been kind of sidelined. Possibly they could still be a way forward. In the meantime, when Rohingyas are asked, which is all too rare, they generally say that they would want citizenship before they go back. They would want their citizenship honored as people who have been in that homeland for generations and even centuries. Barring that, there have to be some improvements in the refugee camp situation, certainly, making it sustainable in every possible way. Making sure that the people of Bangladesh don't suffer themselves because of it. Third country.
Right, Bangladesh is an extremely poor country by itself.
Yes, it's very crowded itself, exactly. And third country repatriation is certainly an option, although these are just, you know, hundreds of thousands of people at this point. There's a vibrant but small Rohingya community in the United States, and certainly more of these people should be welcomed here under our much beleaguered refugee program. And other countries could also take many, many of these people to ease some of the stress and pressure on Bangladesh.
Right. Well, Edith, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and for all the years of work that you've done on this issue. It's our pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much.
My guest has been Edith Mirante. She's the director of Project MAGE, which is an independent information project on Burma/Myanmar's human rights and environmental issues. She's the author of two books on Myanmar. Her most recent book is The Wind in the Bamboo Journeys in Search of Asia's Negrito Indigenous Peoples. And she's been covering the issue of Rohingya for years. She specifically covered the 1990s Rohingya refugee crisis and the exodus to Bangladesh. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.